show. I'm your host, Phil Drew, administrator. And our first guest today is Bob Barr. He's a member of the Long-Term Strategy Project for Protecting Democratic Norms in the War on Terrorism at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's a former federal prosecutor, was on the House Judiciary Committee that handed down articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton, woohoo, and he writes for Creative Loafing, United Press International, does a radio show of his own, sits on the board of the NRA, and works with the ACLU on privacy issues. Welcome to the show, Mr. Barr.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you and your listeners this weekend.
Well, and it's an honor to have you on. I have to say, you're the first guest I've ever had on the show who actually voted for the Patriot Act.
Well, I tell you, it's something that I regret now with all that's happened since the Patriot Act was passed. At that time, none of us really anticipated just how far the government would go in taking away civil liberties, including our right to privacy, not just with the Patriot Act. There's so many other aspects. There's a many-headed hydra here that we have. The Patriot Act, the computer-assisted passenger profiling system, known as CAPS-2. We have the TIA, the Total Information Awareness System. We have the Matrix system. Every time you turn around, there's another one of these privacy-invasive so-called tools to fight terrorism that the federal government is attempting to implement, and it's really getting very, very scary out there.
It's the Patriot Act itself is over 500 pages long, right?
I don't recall exactly how many, but it was very long. And at the time that we passed it, the reason that I had decided at the time to vote for it 2.5 years ago, the administration had worked with us into Congress, those of us that had serious concerns about it. They had made, the administration had made some adjustments to the Patriot Act to remove some of its more onerous provisions. They assured us that it would be used just to fight cases of terrorism, and they said this was all that they needed. Well, as it's turned out, the government is now seeking additional powers. They're using the Patriot Act for purposes that they said they would not use it for, and that is run-of-the-mill criminal cases. They have not been forthcoming with the Congress and the American people in telling us how it's being used so that we can properly evaluate whether or not it needs to be changed in some way. And we now see that the Patriot Act is simply one piece of an overall mosaic that of government power that they're trying to use to dramatically change constitutional law in this country.
I saw you on C-SPAN, I guess, last week, and it was a Cato panel on militarization of law enforcement. And one of the things you said there was that the Patriot Act itself opened the floodgates in allowing exceptions to posse comitatus. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
One of the things that I've been concerned about for quite some time is the this concept that it's okay now for the military to become involved in domestic law enforcement. That's something that I, as a conservative, have always opposed. It's something that our founding fathers disdained greatly. That's why we have the Third Amendment to the Constitution that prohibits the quartering of troops in people's homes. And that's why over 100 years ago, in the wake of the Civil War, the country, the Congress, and the president at that time signed a law that prohibits the military from becoming involved in domestic law enforcement unless there's a specific exclusion. Well, what's happened since 9/11 is the government is saying, well, this is a war, and the war is on our soil, and therefore we can do whatever we want, and we need to have the military involved. As a matter of fact, the government is claiming that the resolution authorizing the use of force to go after al-Qaeda and those responsible for the 9/11 attacks implicitly or impliedly authorized the government as an exception to posse comitatus to use the military domestically. I disagree very strongly with that, but we see more and more of that, and we also see sort of the other side of that coin. We see a market increase in the militarization of domestic law enforcement. This first came to my mind, tragically, when we had the hearings in which I participated in 1995 on Waco. We saw the assault on the Branch Davidian compound as a military operation. We saw and now see so many local police operating with black uniforms, with automatic weapons and assault helicopters and so forth. So I think this is something that we the people need to really convey to our members of Congress and our senators and our local officials that we don't want the continued militarization of local law enforcement, nor do we want the federal government through its military involving itself in domestic law enforcement matters.
Well, and the feds keep giving free equipment, all this SWAT gear and machine guns and armored personnel carriers. They just give it away free to the local police departments, right?
The federal government is encouraging the militarization of local law enforcement by giving away military equipment or making it available to local law enforcement at ridiculously low prices. Grants are available for local law enforcement to become involved in, with special units and SWAT teams and all that sort of thing. And it's not just through federal law enforcement agencies. Surprisingly, just a couple of years ago, right before I left the Congress, I visited a very small local law local law enforcement agency in West Georgia, and they had just received several automatic weapons, M16s, I think. And they said, well, we got these from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And, of course, my thought is, what in the heck is FEMA, that is supposed to be out there worrying about floods and tornadoes, doing in the business of handing out military weapons to local law enforcement?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I've done a little bit of research on this topic, and I've found executive orders dating back to Richard Nixon that, I guess, sit there on standby mode or whatever, but that if activated, basically provide for the takeover of the whole country. I don't remember all the numbers dating all the way back, but I know Bill Clinton's executive order was called 12919, and in there it describes a total military takeover of the United States, all of it run by the head of FEMA who reports back to the president.
Well, you've put your finger on something that is extremely important and very, very few people know anything about, and that is executive orders. This is a power that was always intended to, going back to the days of George Washington, to be simply an administrative exercise. The administration, any president, could issue an executive order that dealt with simply the internal management of the executive branch agencies. And now it's become a way to circumvent the law and basically circumvent the will of the Congress. One of Clinton's advisors, Paul Begala, once said on an interview in describing how nice executive orders were, he said, well, stroke of the pen, law of the land, kind of cool. And that was the typical attitude of Clinton, but unfortunately, Clinton didn't start that trend. It started in probably the 1960s, is continued even through today with Republican administrations. There was an executive order that was issued last year, I think shortly after the invasion of Iraq, in which President Bush signed an executive order that said basically anybody that has a claim against what's going on in Iraq with regard to oil and energy and so forth, you're out of luck. The courts are not going to hear those sorts of arguments. So even today, we have an awful lot of executive orders that remain on the books, as you say. They never go away. They can be dusted off and used whenever they want, and we have more and more on the books. And I introduced a bill in the Congress a few years ago while I was in the Congress to try and at least bring some accountability to executive orders. And you would have thought the sky is falling. The executive branch came up and said, oh, we can't have this. We can't have our hands tied. And this is a very serious problem and something that truly is eroding our separation of powers.
I got to ask you, how many lines of the Constitution can be crossed out before it's just not the Constitution anymore and the thing's dead?
Well, we're fast reaching that point. For example, when going back to where we started here today, with regard to the Patriot Act and the passenger profiling system and the total information awareness, basically, if we allow this trend to continue, what we will have done is we will have gutted the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which prohibits the government from gathering evidence on somebody without a good reason, without probable cause, without suspicion that you've done something wrong. We are now entering an era in which the government, all, of course, in the name of fighting terrorism and making us safer, so they say, now believes that it can gather evidence on people and use it against them without any suspicion whatsoever that they've done anything wrong. And if we, in fact, don't stop this trend, and a number of us have been trying to get Congress to amend the Patriot Act to rein it in a little bit, for example, if we don't stop this trend, then we will, in fact, have gutted that one most important provision of the Bill of Rights, and that is the Fourth Amendment, that defines the whole right to privacy and with it the very nature of our society. So I think it's extremely important, and we're just about at the point now where the Constitution means very little. Thankfully, the Supreme Court is going to be taking on a couple of these cases over the course of the next few months, and I hope and pray that they will stand up for the Constitution and not blindly, sort of in a knee-jerk fashion, say, well, since the federal government says it's to fight terrorism, we can't get involved. I hope they don't do that.
Well, didn't the Supreme Court just uphold part of the Patriot Act a couple of weeks ago?
I'm not aware that part of the Patriot Act was upheld a couple of weeks ago. There have been a couple of cases recently at which a couple of the power grabs by the federal government, for example, the power that it says it now has to arrest and detain American citizens indefinitely, that is, for the rest of their lives, that the federal government decides to, simply because the federal government decides unilaterally that a person is a, quote, enemy combatant, the Supreme Court will be taking that issue up, which is a very important question.
Right, but that's all just by executive order, right? That doesn't have anything to do with the Patriot Act, does it?
Well, that does not have anything specifically to do with the Patriot Act. It has to do with the government's assertion that it can define, when we are in a state of war, that it doesn't need to go to Congress. It can define what an act of terrorism is. It can define what an enemy combatant is, even if it's a U.S. citizen, and it can prevent that person from even going into court in the first place to determine whether or not they're being held unlawfully. That's the extent of the power that the government is now asserting.
You know, in the 1990s, there were a lot of people on the right who were very suspicious of Bill Clinton, did not trust him with any power whatsoever. There are tremendous fights in Congress over every little thing. And, you know, it kind of seems to me that, you know, I guess you're the exception to this rule, but it seems like once George Bush got in power, that all those conservatives forgot how dangerous government was, and now they think it's just fine as long as the Republicans are doing it.
It's very disturbing to see that trend, and you're absolutely correct. It is becoming very pronounced. All is not lost, though. I've been very pleased that even though the neocons, the neoconservatives, that like a very imperialistic foreign policy, a very activist government at home, differing from the liberals only in what they want to use government for, even though they seem to be in control of the government, there are some true conservatives, folks such as Bruce Otter out in Idaho, and of course Ron Paul, who's always been a very strong constitutionalist from Texas there. There are a number of these folks in the Congress that are hearing from their citizens and organizations back home that we are concerned about these power grabs by the activist, both foreign and domestic policy by the administration, and are standing up to it. That's why, for example, last summer, the House of Representatives passed the so-called Otter Amendment that Bruce Otter of Ohio proposed that would have cut off funds for the government to conduct so-called sneak and peek searches. Even though that didn't pass the Senate, at least we passed the House, and it woke up a lot of members as to some of the real dangers that are out there.
Now, the SAFE Act in the Senate, was that the corollary to the Otter bill?
The SAFE Act goes actually beyond. The SAFE Act, which is proposed and now pending in the Senate, sponsored by Larry Craig, a very strong conservative Republican, and Richard Durbin, a very liberal Democrat. It would simply take a few of the more onerous provisions of the Patriot Act and place limits on them. It doesn't repeal the Patriot Act. It doesn't even repeal any provisions of it. It simply says, for example, that the so-called sneak and peek provisions that allow the government now to conduct, as a matter of routine in any criminal case, a search or a seizure without notifying the person that their home or business has been searched or information off of their computer seized, could only be conducted in cases of true terrorism, if there's a real emergency. And even though the administration strongly opposes this, it highlights the inconsistency in the administration's arguments, because limiting the Patriot Act to cases truly involving terrorism was exactly what the administration said it needed the Patriot Act for in the first place. And now, when Larry Craig, for example, proposes the SAFE Act, which does exactly that, it's sort of humorous to watch the administration howl and say, oh, this is terrible, you're limiting the Patriot Act to cases involving terrorism, and we can't have that.
Yeah, well, and they've been using it in all kinds of cases that have nothing to do with terrorism, isn't that right?
This is one of the reasons why I'm very distressed to see how this has played itself out, and why I'm very sorry that the Patriot Act was passed, because it is now being used by the administration for a wide range of cases that have nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism.
In the State of the Union speech, George Bush said that the sunset provisions were coming up, and he wanted to encourage Congress to repass the Patriot Act or to gut those sunset provisions out. I remember there was something in the news, not Arlen Specter, was it Orrin Hatch, who proposed to gut the sunsets before they even came up?
As a matter of fact, Orrin Hatch proposed that almost a year ago. It's sort of funny. He proposed it almost a year ago to rescind the sunset provisions, which, by the way, as you know, don't apply to most of the Patriot Act. The sunset provision only applies to a small minority of the provisions in the Patriot Act. But Orrin Hatch had proposed almost a year ago that the sunset provisions be repealed. The administration, the president, called for that in his State of the Union. And thankfully, Jim Sensenbrenner, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, in a conference in Washington just a few weeks ago, said, and I think I have his quote right, "Over my dead body will we be doing that." We put those sunset provisions in the Patriot Act for a reason, and we're not going to rescind them even before they go into effect at the end of next year, at the end of 2005. So hopefully at least we will keep those sunset provisions in there until we can take a close and comprehensive look at it toward the end of next year.
Do you think there's any hope that the provisions that do have sunsets on them will be allowed to sunset? I mean, does that seem likely at all?
Well, I'd have to say the odds are stacked against us, simply because, as one of Bob Barr's laws of the universe reads, the most powerful force in the universe is the force of the status quo. And once something becomes the status quo, it's very difficult to get Congress to go against it. But even though it will be difficult to see that some of these provisions are sunsetted, if in fact we keep up the fight, if you and other strong and true conservatives and constitutionalists help out as you've been doing in this effort, I think that our chances will improve greatly over the course of the next year.
Well, I sure hope you're right about that. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you something with a little more detail here. When I interviewed Tim Lynch from Cato, he talked a lot about administrative warrants and administrative subpoenas. And I know that you're a former federal prosecutor, so I'm wondering if maybe you can help explain to people, what does it mean to have an administrative warrant as opposed to just a regular old warrant?
An administrative subpoena, or what's also called a national security letter, is a document that does not go before a federal judge or a federal magistrate. In other words, there's no judicial review, no objective review of it. It is simply drawn up by an executive branch official, say an assistant U.S. attorney, for example, or an assistant attorney general, and it then can be used with the same force and effect as a judicial subpoena, a subpoena issued by a grand jury, for example, or a warrant signed by a judge, and the person to whom it's directed or the entity to whom it's directed, whether it's a library, a gun shop, a doctor's office, whatever it is, the person has to comply with it. The danger here is, as we saw in the, as we've seen in the Patriot Act, and this particular power to issue administrative subpoenas was expanded last year in an amendment to an intelligence authorization bill. This becomes where you have the executive branch serving as both the prosecutor and the court. There's no judicial oversight to make sure that the subpoena, which is an invasion of a person's privacy, which is a Fourth Amendment issue that allows the government to gather evidence that can be used against them, there's no oversight, and that's what's particularly dangerous. Yet we're moving in now into an era where there is an expanded power to issue administrative subpoenas, when what we really ought to be doing is taking a much closer look and limiting that power, not expanding it.
Hear, hear. I know we're almost out of time here, but I wanted to ask you really quick on Waco. I know that you sat on the House Judiciary Committee during those hearings. And, by the way, I love the bit with the Play-Doh. But I'd like to ask you, I've read in the Dallas Morning News that there were up to 14 Delta Force operators at Waco. And there have been accusations that the fire was set and the machine gunning in the back of the house was actually done not by the FBI, but actually by the Army's Delta Force. And since you were on the Judiciary Committee, I suppose you ought to know better than any of us whether that's true or not.
We still don't know for absolute certainty because we were never able to get satisfactory answers to all of our inquiries. I can tell you that there's a serious question in my mind as to how those fires and the explosions occurred. It's also very disturbing that, for example, there were foreign military advisors at Waco, and also, as you may recall, we discussed this at the Posse Comitatus conference just the other day that you mentioned. There was false information given to our military on the border that there was drug dealing or drug lab at the Branch Davidian compound in order to get the federal government to then become involved as an exception to the Posse Comitatus. We know now, and we talked about this at the Waco hearings, that was false information. There was never any evidence that there was a drug lab at the Branch Davidian compound. That was made up. It was false information that was given by law enforcement to the military so that the military could then circumvent, as it were, the Posse Comitatus Act and supply military equipment. And, that occurred. That false information was given. Yet, even though we uncovered that in the Waco hearings, the prior administration did nothing about it. And very insidious because that eats away at the credibility and integrity of our government agencies. And once an agency can get away with providing false information, then another agency is going to do it and another, and pretty soon, circumventing the law becomes the norm.
Yeah, which was definitely the norm in the 1990s.
No doubt about that.
And I know you got to go, but I got to ask you real quick, why did you guys impeach him for the Monica Lewinsky and not for Waco and the missile technology transfers to China?
Well, it's a question that I've asked a lot of folks. When I first filed the very first inquiry of impeachment in 1997, I had not heard of it. None of us had heard of Monica Lewinsky. My concern was exactly as you have said, these other problems, taking foreign money, the violations of our immigration laws, the violations of our campaign finance laws, providing sensitive national security information to Red China in return, I believe, for campaign monies. That was what I thought were the most serious allegations. When we held the impeachment hearings, unfortunately, the House Republican leadership elected to focus only on the Starr report. I think that was a serious tactical and strategic mistake. but they made that decision. And even though during the hearings in the House Judiciary Committee in November and December of 1998, I introduced the Judicial Watch report, for example, which laid out in great detail some of these violations as well. Nobody was interested in leadership. They made the decision that they were going to go just on the Starr report, and that's the way it unfolded. I and a few others tried to get them to focus on these other issues, but we could not move the leadership.
Well, at least you gave it a shot. I tend to think that whole thing, I mean, what would be Henry Hyde's motivation for sticking with just the Starr report?
When the votes
in the Senate had been counted, there wasn't 67 votes in the Senate for the Starr report.
Right. And not only were there not sufficient votes, but the rules of procedure under which they forced us to operate guaranteed that we would not be able to present a case that could get sufficient votes. They prevented us from having witnesses. They prevented us from presenting all of the evidence that we wanted to. There were artificial time restraints placed on us. So there was never really any doubt that the Senate was not going to allow there to be a conviction. But I don't think it was just Henry Hyde. I think it was the Republican leadership for a number of reasons that made that decision. And as it turned out, it was a very, very bad one. But as you say, we those of us that saw the real danger tried. We just didn't have the power to move the Republican leadership.
Okay, and right before I let you go here, I want to ask you a little bit about your work with the ACLU. I really like the fact I'm seeing more and more conservatives and liberals, people on the right and the left and libertarians getting together to fight for the Bill of Rights. And it brings to my mind the idea that maybe we're on the verge of a brand new realignment where maybe really it's not the liberals versus the conservatives anymore, but the statists versus the people who care about being free.
I like the way you put that, because I think I hold out the same optimism. I've been very pleased over the course of the last few years, and especially the last year that I've been out of the Congress and have been working directly with organizations on the right and the left. I do work for the American Conservative Union and also for the American Civil Liberties Union. Even though both the right and the left, these different organizations, have very, very clear and pronounced differences, I mean, heck, I disagree with the ACLU probably on 8 out of 10 issues. But both organizations now recognize that if we are not able to put aside all of those differences and focus and work together on those issues as fundamental as the right to privacy and protecting the Bill of Rights against big government intrusion, we'll have no hope of winning. So I'm very glad to see that as well.
Great. And I know you got to go. I'll have to ask you about the UN gun control thing next time.
Let's talk about that next time, because that is extremely important, and we need to make sure that the people focus on that, because they sure aren't doing it in Washington.
You got that right. Everybody, Bob Barr, he's the former congressman from Georgia. He sits on the board of the NRA. He works with the ACLU. You can look up all his articles at bobbarr.org. If you don't know, it's Barr with two R's, bobbarr.org. And do you have any closing comments, sir?
I just appreciate your focusing on these issues of true freedom. It allows us to get some things done in Washington and in state capitals that we couldn't otherwise do. So keep up the good work.
Well, great. Thank you very much for coming on the show today, sir.
My pleasure. Look forward to it again soon.